Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured. In today's episode, I spoke to Ash Arora. Ash is the youngest partner at Local Glow, a UK-based venture capital firm that focuses on seed and impact investments, leading their Web3 and blockchain practice. In today's episode, we talked about how she went from knowing nothing about VC to going down a three-month rabbit hole, writing a paper on Bitcoin for Citibank, getting into crypto because she was restricted from investing in anything else whilst at Citi, how 99% of the crypto community back in the day didn't know what they were doing.
I would say about 99% of the community back in the day didn't know what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. How she felt at home in London after landing for the first time ever for 20 rounds of face-to-face interviews with Local Glow.
I had never visited London or UK in general.
Wow.
Until I actually landed for the interview. And this was after probably, and I don't know if my team is okay with me sharing this, they were probably like 15 rounds of interviews remotely.
Yeah, sure.
And then they were like 20 in person.
And how that culminated in choosing Local Glow, having 7 job offers in her pocket already. How we are very early in both blockchain and AI, and how security, scalability and cost haven't yet been achieved in blockchain, and why that is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle in blockchain.
That's basically what I call it's the Heisenberg principle problem in blockchain.
Right.
Right. So basically you can't do all three at the same time, which is why it's important to build infrastructure that can actually enable that.
And finally, why Ethereum is the Hugging Face of blockchain. Let's get straight into it. This is Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it. Today on Nothing Ventured, I have with me Ash Arora. Ash is the youngest partner at Local Globe, a UK-based venture capital firm that focuses on seed and impact investments, leading their Web3 and blockchain practice. Before joining Local Globe, she was investments lead at Polygon Labs, leading the $100 million Polygon Ventures Fund, where she focused on early stage Web3 startups with global LPs across the US and Europe. Ash, it is so great to have you with me here today. I know it's been a long time coming. I'm super excited to get into this episode.
Really excited to be here. Can't wait.
Amazing. So let's start off. Your journey into venture was incredibly non-traditional. You were a crypto trader on the side. You set up a proprietary trading shop with some friends before starting to angel invest and built out the largest angel network in Southeast Asia. So can you talk me through that journey in more detail? And what was it about the Web3 blockchain crypto space that got you so excited in those days?
Absolutely. I think if a decade ago you'd asked me if I'd be a sort of venture capitalist in 2024, my question would be, sorry, VC stands for exactly what? Video and camera or something of that sort? So I had absolutely no understanding of the sort of sector at all. I majored in economics and finance at LSR in Delhi. And post that, I started working in Citi. So every sort of, you know, fresher commits the crime of going into consulting or banking. So my poison was banking. Got into it, was working in markets on the sales and trading floor. Started out with sales in FX and then eventually gravitated towards trading. A few months in, I was asked to do a small research project on Bitcoin because this is right after the second bull run of Bitcoin. And, you know, I was the youngest on the floor by a decade. And we, like Citi Markets India, was the second largest by revenue for Citibank globally for markets. So number one being Brazil, number three being the US. That, yeah, I don't know if things have changed now. But so I did that and I spent 3 months going exceptionally deep into it. I literally understood the technical side of it. I started looking at Ethereum as well, which was not really trendy back in the day. It was fairly new. And a bunch of other, what I now call shitcoins. And yeah, after 3 months, I'm hoping no Citibanker is listening to this, but they pretty much threw it out the window. They said that this is too unregulated. This is too speculative. We are not going to do shit with it.
Okay.
And that ended my sort of research project immediately. But I had gone so deep and I was personally excited and all my friends and family were tired of me talking about it. So when I got my Christmas bonus, I was unable to figure out what to do with it because, you know, when you're a trader, you can't really access investment opportunities across any of the asset classes that you are trading for your clients. Mm-hmm. So immediately, I only had pretty much two options. Either I sort of, you know, invest that in real estate or I invested in something else because I just didn't want to keep it in my bank account. So the something else became crypto. Mm-hmm. And I put money where my mouth is. And then my portfolio that I had created nearly 6x'd in 3 months.
Wow.
And I went bonkers because I said, what the hell is happening here? Is this something that's really shady? Should I just now pull my money out? You know, this is like, this is how a 21-year-old would think. Hey, I've made enough money. I'm completely inexperienced. I have no idea what I'm doing. So let me just pull it out. But then I thought, okay, before I do that, I'm an economist by trade. There's a supply demand in every single market. Let me try to dig deeper as to why this is the case. And once I started digging deeper, I invested more. Mm. And then since then, I would remember 30% of my monthly salary actually would go into crypto.
Amazing.
Across different types of cryptocurrencies. And then shortly after that, I would say within 3 to 4 months, I met a couple of friends of mine that I had known during my uni days through like inter-college competitions and stuff like that, who were both coders. So we'd hung out a bunch and then we all grabbed dinner and we basically came up with the idea because they were doing something in the equity market and I recommended, why don't we try this in the crypto market?
Yeah.
And then we ended up doing algorithmic trading with crypto. This is how we started our prop trade, like a very small, sort of like a niche prop trading firm where we started with doing strategic arbitrage. So like buying in Kenya, selling in Korea, stuff like that.
Mm.
Just kind of, you know, arbitraging the Forex as well as the kind of illiquid markets. Mm. Or I won't say illiquid, like sort of slightly less liquid markets across different geographies. But then we graduated up and we became smarter and we started doing algo trading using LSTM models. So that's long short-term memory models. Did that for, I think, close to 2 years. And then we ended up sort of, you know, there was like a very clear bear market and we were getting bored. So all the returns that we had made, we started angel investing with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how one of the largest curated Southeast Asian angel networks was born. We have like a bunch of unicorn founders in that network now, and we all would get like really quality deal flow. So we started angel investing together. And all of this is happening on the side. I'm still very much at Citi. So like, I've not quit my day job.
And zero problems at Citi, because I know exactly as you said, there are restrictions
none.
Around what you can do. So this was basically the best way for you to invest your capital within the bounds of what you were able to do whilst working at Citi.
Exactly. So like, it's so funny. My MD at that time, and he is now, I think, head of Citi Korea or something.
Mm.
I'd run it by him and I was like, oh, I'm happy to kind of drop an email to compliance and like CC you and stuff like that. He's like, oh no, you might as well just do it yourself. You know, eventually, like if you learn something, we learn something. So that's good for us. So that's basically, that was it. There was no other conversation because at that point, you know, crypto as an asset class was not seen as a financial, institutional, enterprise grade asset class. It was seen as something that, you know, basically people dealing with black money and like all illegal activities were dealing with. Like when you Google the word crypto, the top 10 articles wouldn't be, oh, Binance or, oh, this utility or scalability of blockchains. The top 10 would be, oh, this crypto fraud was caught. That happened. This government did something shady with crypto, right? Like those would be the top 10 articles. Everything was very scammy and fraudy. So yeah, that's something that was very organic for me. And I ended up sort of running sort of the firm. And then also doing angel investing. But after Citi, I wanted to do something slightly more impactful. I just didn't feel trading in general. And I still have the same opinion that trading doesn't really bring that kind of positive value in the world.
Sure.
That it has the potential to, given the quality of talent that gravitates towards trading.
Yeah. So trading typically is more about how do you make money rather than how do you make impact, right? As opposed to sort of venture or angel investing where you are going in early and hopefully supporting projects that have the opportunity to change things. So a couple of questions there, I guess. The first question is, you know, whilst you were getting into trading crypto, and we all know kind of how much of a wild west the whole crypto ecosystem was at one point, arguably maybe still is, who knows? I certainly don't, think I have the answers. But how would you differentiate between, you know, to use the obvious terminology, how would you differentiate between what was likely to be a shitcoin versus what was likely to be a more, a more impactful investment or a more impactful coin? And then the second kind of question is, with the angel investing, were you investing again in crypto projects, or was that predominantly, more general sort of typical software and other sort of ventures?
Yeah, brilliant questions. To answer the first one, I would say it was actually exceptionally hard to do that. I would be one of the very few brown or very few females in the trading chat rooms back in the day. Yeah. Okay. I didn't have like a frat club or a bro club that would tell me, hey, this is somebody credible building, you should buy the token. Mm. So the way I actually went about doing that was I started looking at, the Twitter pages, for example. I remember this is like, I'm 22 at this point, and I'm trying to figure out how do people know authentic versus inauthentic?
Yeah, exactly.
And I started looking at their Twitter pages, and I would look at who are the people following that page. Mm-hmm. So like imagine the Paul Graham equivalent or Peter Thiel equivalent of Web3 at that time. If someone like that is following a page, I'm like, dude, that's legit, okay. Right? Like I should definitely kind of look at it. Yeah. And then I would sort of, try to understand the research that they've done better, the white paper that they have published. I would try to understand the tokenomics. I would try to simulate the sort of tokenomics myself. Mm-hmm. I would create like an Excel file of my own, not look at what they have done and try to kind of simulate that sort of in my records. Even after all of these filtrations, nothing worked. I would say about 99% of the community back in the day didn't know what they were doing. Mm-hmm. They were pretty much like, even the most incredible successful people in the space were following everyone, mm-hmm. right? And it was very hard to filter quality from noise, right? Like the signal to noise ratio was completely messed up. So because of that, I think I kind of came to a level where I stopped saying that, okay, let me trust what somebody else believes in, which is what I was doing by seeing who's following them, and start trusting my own mind. So that took me a couple of years to learn. And that took me a lot of, personal capital wasted to get to the conclusion for. And I then realized that I'm just going to read the white papers. I'm going to do my own work. I will speak to the team before buying the token, which is what I rarely used to do back in the day. Mm-hmm. So that is a trader mentality, right? You look at what's available and you make like a quick decision. Then came the investor mindset where I was like, okay, let me go deeper. Let me see the kind of people they are. Let me psychoanalyze them. Let me get to know them. Would this be a person I would grab a beer with later? Mm-hmm. Stuff like that, right? Like, would this be a person I would want to kind of be in business with? I think once I did that, my hit rate improved 100%. So that's how I think I started differentiating between the two kind of.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the it's that typical thing. I remember seeing a bunch of crypto deals and there was like one with, Mike Tyson was the front man for the deal. And you're like, Mike Tyson's promoting it, must be legit. And it's like, well, hold on. If Mike Tyson's promoting it, probably isn't legit. Like you can't rely. And it was the whole kind of, it was that whole sort of pyramid scheme type, attitude, I guess, right? Where if you have someone really big kind of marketing it, then you could bring others behind you, irrespective of the legitimacy, I guess, of the project itself. And I think that quickly unwound when people started realizing exactly as you did. I guess one of the questions that comes out of that, and it's something that I'm interested in, is like, how different is tokenomics from traditional economics or econometric, like in terms of actually working out the tokenomics of a coin? Like, how hard is that to do from first principles versus traditional economic kind of analysis?
I think honestly it's easier.
Oh wow.
And I think when we do econometric analysis, and this is, I mean, takes me back to like city days or even like back to my degree, there are so many different variables that are very hard to kind of make assumptions for. Mm-hmm. Right, so you basically end up running like probability and probabilistic models to predict like a chi-square 95% confidence interval level sort of prediction numbers. And then you retrofit them into the model. Mm-hmm. And even after that, you have like sort of some end level margin assumption and margin bandwidth that you leave so that there's like room for error, mm-hmm. right? While in tokenomics, there are so many assumptions. Mm-hmm. It makes your life so much simpler because I can simulate a tokenomics in less than an hour.
Oh, wow.
While building an econometric model from scratch for me would take like weeks.
Right.
For sure. If you read the white paper well enough and you're able to simulate the economics, the tokenomics based on what you've read, and you are able to, I think the biggest assumption is, or the biggest answer that you want to kind of chase is how is the value being accrued over a period of time, right? So think of, let's say, cash flows. In standard sort of businesses, when we say B2B SaaS businesses, it's very easy because we know that there's going to be regular cash flows like every single month. If the numbers might be different, but we are going to make money from the same product every single month. Now with tokenomics, that's not the case. there could be demand for the token in 1 month and there could be zero demand for the token next month. Yeah. And people think that this is a theoretical assumption. It's not. It's actually what we see practically, and there's enough data backing it. So when you have something that is as irregular, like an IRR equivalent is not possible to be calculated. Yeah. That's where you call, like, you know, in the financial world, we would calculate, let's say, XIRR for something like this, right? Mm-hmm. The extended IRR.
Yeah.
But in the tokenomics space, you don't even have cash flow. Mm. It's not even about regular versus irregular. There is no cash flow. Mm. Because of that, none of the existing economic sort of, you know, formulas and the tools that we have
they
for finance, like this, yeah, businesses, they don't make sense. Mm. Which is why we have to kind of come up with something new. So that is where we come up with velocity of money. We come up with, you know, fully diluted valuations. We look at market cap. We look at float. So many different, like, terminologies have come up. And there are so many of these things that were there. Obviously, market cap was there. Float was there, and like equity markets as well. But like something like VIX that exists in equities, like, you know, the Cboe Volatility Index, like all of these things that are used to track volatility in sort of equity markets, you have something equivalent now in blockchain markets as well. So you have like parallels and similarities, but like a lot of the fundamental stuff, which is around the business model, we can't really compare.
Yeah.
So it's totally entirely different.
Yeah. But to your point, it makes it easier to model because you have a set of assumptions that you can essentially port to every tokenomic model that you
exactly
build, right?
And obviously it depends on the tokenomics as well, right? So let me take an example of, let's say, consumer tech business versus you know, like a services business versus a B2B SaaS business.
Hmm.
So all three would have, consumer tech would have gross margin mm-hmm. as the source of revenue. SaaS would have, you know, ARR, like cash flow in general.
Mm-hmm.
And then your sort of services business would have, let's say, a take rate or a commission.
Yeah.
Just taking three very different types of business models. None of these three existing are interrelated at all.
Yeah.
Right? There is no overlap. They were new sort of business models that were accepted by sort of, you know, the business people in the world
mm-hmm.
As like legit business models. Tokenomics is one such new business model.
Yeah.
That's basically what it is. There is no precedence for it, but that's fine. There was no precedence for take rate before it became a thing.
Yeah.
Right? There was no precedence for, I mean, like, for example, take rate, okay, goes back centuries. We can literally talk about SaaS. Still 25 years ago, nobody thought anybody would pay a monthly subscription for anything.
Yeah.
From at least a retail lens.
Well, cloud,
right?
cloud didn't even exist, right? So from
exactly.
a SaaS perspective, everything was either on-prem or whatever. So you were selling, you weren't selling software as a service. You were selling software. That was it, right? Like you
exactly.
sell the
so
software
there was an
once
upfront
and that was it.
Cost.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, when you buy FIFA for your PlayStation, you pay for the game upfront, but when you play it on a monthly basis, you don't pay anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's exactly the model that humanity was used to, like an upfront cost, which also goes back to consumer tech, which is gross margin.
Yeah.
So there was no regular cash flow consumer sort of, you know, mentality that this would actually result in regular cash flows that also, you know, helps meet working capital requirements, if at all. And then on top of that, that is also sustainable. And then there are predictions made around NRR compatibility with ARRs. So all of that didn't exist.
Mm.
And now we've learned that. We know that. Everyone knows that. So it's similar to tokenomics. Like till 5-7 years ago, maybe like actually a decade ago, tokenomics didn't exist. And now tokenomics, in my opinion, is actually a legit business model. As long as you can make the right assumptions, as long as you can understand the value being accrued over a period of time is related to the current product and how the current product would evolve given the kind of distribution it has.
Yeah.
So we can obviously go into examples, but yeah, I think that's at a macro level, that's very important.
Yeah, I mean, the way I think about it, like as a CFO, when we're forecasting out a business, you are having to build a set of assumptions, whether it is for SaaS and you're thinking about churn rates, LTV, where you're talking about NRR, you're talking about new models and upsell and so on and so forth, versus, you know, consumer business, to your point, you know, it's around repeat purchase rates and all these sort of things, your cost of, you know, your cost of goods and so on. So tokenomics, to your point, is a new business model that was not fully fleshed out, but is now becoming more fleshed out, and at some point may get adopted in a wider way as more sort of valuable crypto projects, I guess, start appearing or have appeared over time. And then that sort of second question, like, so was the angel investing predominantly in crypto, or was that across like different verticals?
So angel investing, you know, back in 2018, there were not enough crypto companies raising. And in India or Asia, there was obviously like lack of enough information. But even in the Western world, I don't think that there were enough companies raising that I would feel, okay, this is like worth running an entire angel network for.
Yeah.
So did look at a bunch of Web3 companies and do them, but like mostly focused on Web2. And I think my overarching thesis across all the angel investment that I've made has always been Indian founders or Indian origin founders. I think the heart wants what it wants. I still eat Indian food every day. So I think there's just this soul connection with India. And I don't want to kind of ever let it go, which is why I think I'm just generally very excited by anybody who has sort of come from India or has an Indian origin or has that mentality that, you know, all of us are raised with. And if they're building anywhere in the world, in any sector, I would always be game to talk to them.
Amazing.
So that's basically how I've done all my interviews.
Well, I mean, like, so as a person of Indian origin, albeit via East Africa, I think that's a wonderful way to look at it. And I think, look, especially as an angel investor, you get to do what you want, right? Like as a professional investor, you have to work within the bounds of a thesis, et cetera, et cetera. But as an angel investor, you can choose to invest in what you want to invest in. I think, you know, that is a wonderful philosophy to have. But you moved from India to the UK to join Local Globe. So tell me a little bit about why you decided to make that move and what it is about Local Globe that meant that it was the right firm for you to join at this point in your venture career. And we haven't talked about how old you are, but you are the youngest partner at Local Globe. So it would be great to kind of understand a bit about that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the move to UK was actually a very funny one. I had never visited London or UK in general.
Wow.
Until I actually landed for the interview. Okay. And this was after probably, and I don't know if my team is okay with me sharing this, there were probably like 15 rounds of interviews remotely.
Yeah, sure.
And then there were like 20 in person.
Wow.
So there were basically a lot of interviews, let me put it that way. Before I actually sort of, you know, when I sort of went through all the rounds and they said, okay, you should fly to London, they were appalled to find out I need a visa for that, even to visit.
Yeah.
So that was extremely funny. And then getting the visa was also an extremely long process. And even though we like sort of paid for all the priority, we still sort of had to kind of wait for a while. And my biggest concern was, oh my God, they're going to find someone else.
Yeah.
But yeah, that didn't happen. They did wait. So I'm very fortunate and glad that they did. So yeah, that's how I came to London for the first time. Prior to moving to the UK, I have lived across Singapore and Dubai for brief periods of time professionally. And I never really connected with either of the two sort of cities, countries. I just, never felt home. And the 10-day or like a 12-day period that I spent in London during the interview process actually felt like home, which was incredibly funny because it was a difficult time. I had to like switch hotels and like, yeah, cabs are difficult to find in London. So it was, and this is in the summer, right? It's so hard.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a painful time, but I still felt like this is where I belong. And I moved in the peak of winter, which was November 22. And 2 weeks after I moved, I saw snowfall for the first time in my life. Please remember, I come from a very tropical country. You don't see a lot of snowfall there.
Yeah.
So even in spite of all these weather changes, I felt really sick for like a month. All of this happened, yet I feel still to this very day, I feel like this is home. So yeah, I think London just sort of has this charm that very few people in their lifetime get to experience. And I think I'm one of the few lucky ones.
Yeah, it's weird. I wrote something recently. I go hot and cold on London all the time. Like I have to say, you know, the winter months really do. I mean, like coming from Africa where there's sun and, you know, you can be outdoors. It can be really bad. But then, you know, those days where you get this beautiful sunlight coming through the city, the energy that actually London brings, I like having traveled a lot in my life, whether, you know, lived in Australia and Papua New Guinea, and obviously throughout Africa, Europe, the US and elsewhere, London just has this combination of both, you know, its historic roots, but the energy of the future really does feel like things are happening here. Or it certainly did feel like things are happening here. I think, you know, post-Brexit, a little bit of a change, but I won't talk about that too much. And why did you think Local Globe was the right kind of fund for you?
So there's actually a very long LinkedIn post on this. Mm-hmm. So I won't bore you with the details. We can probably plug in the link in the end. But yeah, I think for me, I was interviewing with a bunch of sort of funds across the world. So I had, not to toot my own horn, this sounds weird, but I had 7 job offers when I decided to kind of go with Local Globe. And what I did was I was really struggling. I didn't, you know, come from a family where people understand tech or VC or finance or run public listed companies. Like I didn't have any of that kind of mentorship. So I started Googling and researching and DMing people. And I did about 2 months worth of research. I remember I had over 100 coffees in those 2 months, which was basically me being extremely caffeinated all the time. But the reason I did that, and I traveled across the world to make that happen. The reason I did that was because I wanted to understand, how do you decide where to work? Very simply, irrespective of whether it's a VC fund, whether it's a tech role, whether it's banking or anything in the world. So I created a framework where it has 52 parameters. It has sort of very VC specific stuff, but it also has very non-VC specific stuff. Compensation and, you know, the total money that you make in a single role for me was not very high, simply because I think my target number that I wanted to achieve in my lifetime, I hit at fairly early, but I also come from a very poor family. So like that number was very low to begin with. And for me, I think it was more about the culture, the learning that I have and the kind of work that I'm doing and whether I'm on the right side of humanity. So I think these were the kind of factors that played a very big overarching role. So like there are weightages assigned to each of the 52 parameters. I ranked all the 7 offers that I had. I went back to the funds and I got so much information from them. And I told them that I'm doing this, so like, please kind of share some. And all of them did, which I'm very sort of, you know, in a very privileged position to actually say that they did. And I ended up at Local Globe. They scored the highest, but even the highest score is not above 90. Let's put it that way. So I am, let's say I'm a very brutal assessor. And after I joined my managing partner, he didn't know about this. So when I told him, he said, oh, it's so funny. 52 is actually my lucky number. And I also just turned 52.
Okay.
I'm like, okay, I'm your lucky charm. That's what it is. Like, yeah. I'm here to be your lucky charm. And then when I showed him the framework, he was extremely impressed by it. But then the first question he said was not that, oh, I'm glad that we ranked number one across all these global funds. But the number one thing he said was, where did we lose all these marks?
Yeah, where could we have done better? Yeah.
Exactly. And then all the things that actually sort of I deducted scores for are things that I have actually seen, you know, they have either involved me in or have recommended I take it up as an internal project. So that I'm the one who's leading it and there's no conversation around, oh, Ash is young, she might not know how things are done, maybe this is a different way of doing things, whatever. They were completely comfortable with me doing everything as well.
Yeah.
So I think it's not just why I joined Local Globe, it's also why I will stay with Local Globe for a very long time, is because of all of these factors. And the framework is public. I'm happy to share the link afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. It also, I guess, tells anyone that is looking to receive investment from Ash, be prepared for a very grueling process. Because if you went through 52 questions just to figure out which your perfect job was going to be, I am fairly certain you're going to have a just as an intense process for any investments that you're looking at. But look, on a more serious note, I think, you know, that is a great way of approaching it. I mean, I think, you know, whether you had 7 job offers, 20 job offers or 2 job offers, you want to make the choice that is right for you, especially if you're moving across the globe. Let's face it, Delhi to London is a big move. You're leaving behind family, et cetera, et cetera. You want to feel like this is a place where I can grow and where I can, you know, where I can achieve what I want to achieve in an environment where that will be supported rather than pushed back on. So no, I think that's incredible. We've had a few guests on the podcast with varying takes on the whole Web3 space, and it would be hard to suggest that it hasn't fallen out of favor and flavor, I guess, in the wider VC ecosystem after some of the hype in the early 2020s, which then culminated in the NFT craze, amongst other things. So why are you still bullish on Web3 and blockchain, and where do you see the fundamental shift happening that will tip the balance and interest back to ventures built on-chain versus sort of Web2?
Right, absolutely. So I think for me, I am of the opinion, be it blockchain, be it even AI, I think we are extremely early in both the sectors. We are earlier in blockchain than we are in AI, but we are still at a very infrastructure middleware level. The reason I say that is because even today, what is the biggest problem? Like, think of it this way. You travel so much. You yourself are of Indian African origin. Prior to Wise, how would you send money to Africa?
I mean, look, my daughter is sitting there at the moment on a rhino farm with a Wise account. Like, it's the only way. The only other way was like, get there, Havela style, get some cash off uncle or whatever. And then M-Pesa came along that made life easier. But even M-Pesa, for example, unless you have a local number, you can't use M-Pesa. So yeah, I mean, it's difficult to say the
There's
least.
There's so many different tricky challenges. And this is Africa we are talking about. The sort of people should know the Wise founders are of African origin. So Africa was a very, very big focus.
I was not aware of that, actually.
Wow. Yeah. So they basically, one of the reasons why they started was because they were not able to kind of send money outside of London. So Ethiopia and Africa was actually sort of core focus for them in the very initial days as well. So they were able to kind of get Africa on board fairly early, where generally in emerging markets, Africa is generally one of the last geographies to be onboarded. So I'm from India. When I moved to the UK, it was so painful because I was not able to transfer any capital.
Mm-hmm.
So as an Indian, like, and as an Asian brown immigrant, you don't have any credit history.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny. Monzo is a portfolio company, and I got rejected for a Monzo bank account when I moved here, which is actually sort of majority immigrants are able to get that.
Yeah.
I ended up only with a Revolut account and a Yonder credit card. So Yonder is also a portfolio company. So I'm very grateful that they sort of were able to approve me. But yeah, I couldn't get an Amex. I couldn't get an HSBC. I couldn't get Monzo. And the reason I couldn't do that, or even, by the way, get like an apartment.
Yeah. I had company accommodation. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Longer than most people, simply because I didn't have 3 months payslips for me to actually kind of get any kind of, you know, sort of place to live or a bank account for that matter. This is the fundamental. And this is someone who came in on a tier two visa in the UK. There are 5 or 6 different types of visas. Imagine a tier 5 visa holder. How would they travel across the world? It's next to impossible for someone like them to even get a bank account after a year. So it's very fundamental to the regulatory issues that we face globally. And all of that goes down to, hey, is this person going to overstay their welcome in any geography? Is this person going to commit fraud, et cetera, et cetera? So these are things that historically no tech product has been able to track.
Mm-hmm.
This is where I feel blockchain plays a role. So many use cases, we can get into them at a later point, where from a consumer and a B2B application space, I see a lot of really tangible use cases where blockchain can actually make life so much easier. But at a very fundamental infrastructure level, why has cross-border, for example, not been solved by blockchain even today? Like, why is this not operational in India? There's literally still, to this day, there's no way that I can bring money from India to London, except for maybe a bank account transfer, which is extremely high in fees.
Yeah.
So it monetarily doesn't make sense for me to do that, right? So yeah, the reason why that has not happened is because lack of infra. That's the problem. Even right now, when we compare to, let's say, a bank account transfer versus all the fees that we'll have to pay. So we'll have to pay gas fees when we're doing a blockchain transaction. We'll have to do off-ramp and on-ramp from one geography to another. We'll have to pay the conversion fee to each of the exchanges that we are transferring, like the wallet providers, exchanges that we are using. We'll have to pay so much fees. It's so funny because blockchain, to kind of transfer the money, is free.
Seamless, right? Yeah.
Exactly. It's literally free. There's literally no cost associated with it. There's no middle person that will sort of cash in on that. But because of the environment that we are in and this infrastructure that we have, we still have to pay at the two endpoints.
Yeah.
And the total cost of doing that sort of goes above a bank account or a Swift transaction cost, which is why there's not been enough adoption yet, right? Yeah. So everyone on the world, right? Visa, MasterCard, you know, TransferWise, Robinhood, like any sort of retail, sort of fintech player has already been aware of blockchain for a while, and they will sort of adapt to it and they will kind of integrate that once the infrastructure is there.
Once the fees have lowered because the infrastructure is now at scale, able to absorb those costs in a more efficient manner.
So, and they're still sort of not compromising on security because you have cheap solutions even today, but then they compromise on security. So it's security and scalability and cost. These are the three sort of parallels. To get all three right now in blockchain is actually not possible, irrespective of whoever is selling you whatever bundled product. I am yet to see. I'm hoping that there's some listener to this podcast who proves me wrong. But there is literally no solution that I have seen globally that solves for all three at the same time. You can solve for two out of the three. This is literally the trilemma that even Vitalik, the Ethereum founder, has mentioned often. You can do two out of three at the same time. It's basically what I call it's the Heisenberg principle problem in blockchain.
Right.
So basically, you can't do all three at the same time, which is why it's important to build infrastructure that can actually enable that. So if you can make a product that is secure, it's scalable, and it is, I won't say like cheap, let's just say it's cost efficient to be comparable to existing fintech and banking infrastructure.
Yeah.
Till we have these three things sorted, I don't see mainstream adoption happening for blockchain. But at the same time, I'm also extremely bullish on the kind of infrastructure that is being built.
Mm.
One of the companies that I've just invested in recently solves for data availability. So they are doing fusion security. They are going to settle on top of Ethereum. They are basically a middleware for Ethereum that has theoretically the potential to solve for this. So that is where we are headed. But I mean, the funny part is we literally did their seed 2 weeks ago. That's how early
okay,
the company
early. I mean, so is it a tech problem? Is it a tech, not like, so I guess, does this problem or do these problems get solved with the technology or through adoption or through scale? Do all of those things have to happen at the same time, essentially, to basically get to a point where you get to an inflection point where all three essentially get solved at the same time? Or yeah. Is it just a case of we got to keep working on the problem? At some stage, someone will come up with a technological solution that allows those to happen. Like where does that inflection point happen? I guess is the question.
So I think it's a tech problem. That's my opinion. I don't think additional scalability or mainstream adoption will solve for it. I think it'll actually make it worse. Mm-hmm. Like in a bull market, Ethereum gas fees goes for a toss.
That's massive. Yeah.
That's because there's a traffic jam on Ethereum.
Yeah.
So like more users, higher the gas fees.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not something that you see in economies of scale.
Yeah. It should reduce over time. Yeah.
Exactly. So that is where basically it's like the way I see it, it's like a Moore's law, but in the opposite direction.
Okay.
Instead of becoming smaller, it becomes bigger, right?
Yeah.
So like that's the core fundamental thing that we need to solve for, which is an infrastructural idea that can act as, let's say, a middleware or an infrastructure that is standalone for this to be scalable. And right. And this is something that we've been discussing in the context of Ethereum for several years.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a cryptography problem. This is very, very academic. It's very theoretical. Like somebody who has not done, in my opinion, like a PhD or like a master's in blockchain or like cryptography is sort of, it's highly unlikely that they'll be able to solve for this.
Yeah.
They can build out the platform, they can build out the product and the tool and everything else because let's say they're an operator, but like the core fundamental mathematics that will need to be done and like the logic and the pipeline algorithms that need to be written needs to be extremely cryptographic.
Mm-hmm.
And we are still not there. Like there were a couple of papers that came out last year towards the end of last year that were very exciting. But yeah, I'm yet to kind of see sort of like beta testing results for those papers. And if that happens, I'm sure one of the really smart product operator founders would catch that and build a product around it, right? So like, I'm hoping that is something that we get to see at least for one company this year. If that happens, you will definitely, hopefully, see me as one of the investors lining up to invest in that company. But yeah, we are just not there yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think about it in two ways. It's a bit like AI, right? AI is the big thing today, but it's 40 years old, right? Like, I mean, AI has been around for a long time.
Yeah.
Crypto in its core, blockchain and crypto in its current sort of form has really only been around a decade, 15 years kind of tops. So we're still, to your point, incredibly early in blockchain. And when you start combining blockchain with AI, then there's a whole new platform that kind of comes out of that as well. And then going back to kind of what you said right at the top, or kind of how you explained, you know, almost how the idea of crypto and blockchain is fundamentally more attuned to kind of these emerging economies. The first use case that I thought of for blockchain, having lived in Papua New Guinea for 10 years, where, you know, we were in legal battles with neighbors around title, around like who owned what piece of property and what land owned who, and there were customary landowners and all this sort of stuff. I was like, okay, well, if you put that land registry on chain, all of a sudden that disappears, and then you have an actual record of who owns what, and it has been, you know, it is completely and utterly, you know, immutable and traceable, and therefore you don't have those issues arise. So I would agree. I actually think that, you know, okay, we went through this whole phase of NFTs and, like, you know, essentially, you know, Bored Apes and all the rest of the kind of crazy stuff that was happening back in 2020. But those were the wrong use cases, right?
Yeah.
Like they weren't solving. And I say this a lot about what's also been happening in venture over the last few years and the last couple of years. We've reverted back to investing, I guess, in heavy R&D sort of projects, which have large, long-term ability to change the way we do things, rather than shorter-term kind of consumerist projects, you know, like 15-minute grocery delivery, or, you know, I think Hussein mentioned, you know, why would anyone have been investing in kind of micro mobility, which is only useful kind of in the summer months or whatever. They you know, they were easy places for that capital to flow. The harder places, those R&D, where you're taking a lot of technical risk as well as commercialization risk, is now where I see venture dollars flowing back into. And maybe that's essentially what's happening with crypto. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of that definitely as well. But there's also, you know, like at a very fundamental level, if you think about, let's say Zoom, mm-hmm. right? So Zoom prior to the pandemic had how many? 10 million, I think, daily or monthly active users.
Yeah.
And within a month of sort of the lockdown and the pandemic, they were above 300 million daily active users.
Yeah.
That is a 30x jump right there, right? So I think what is happening is there are a bunch of these crypto use cases that have very minimal to no users.
Mm-hmm.
But they are still looking for that inflection point. So to the example that you mentioned, which is, you know, put your sort of, you know, land or like land registry on chain. And then that is like the source of gospel truth, right? Like you own the land, you have ownership since this day to this day, whatever. I think, so the very first actually real estate transaction that happened, like purchase of a property that happened on chain, was done by Roofstock, which is a Series D, Series E funded startup, real tech startup based out of the US.
Mm-hmm.
I served as an advisor to their crypto team that was actually running this. And I've stayed very close with them over the last 2 years. And they ended up, I think, kind of halting operations or shutting it down for a while because they realized the biggest problem after investing so much resource and time into it. It is actually very doable. Putting mm-hmm. land registry on chain, as a non-coder, I can do it. It's mm-hmm. fairly simple.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem that exists is around the environment that it sort of like serves.
Mm-hmm.
So land registry by default is a legal document.
Yep.
For, you know, courts to accept a land registry on chain, they need to say, oh, the blockchain knows better than the court does.
Yeah, sure.
So these are human structures that go back thousands of years.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not simple to kind of negate them.
Mm.
So we want to create an environment where we don't need enough people or like manual intervention in basic things that can be solved by treating code as law.
Mm-hmm.
But we also cannot replace law.
Okay.
There's this entire thing, right? Like, and this piece, I can't remember the sort of the author of it, but there's this one piece which is talking about blockchain and AI
mm-hmm.
and the impact on humanity. So like blockchain being code being sort of treated as law, and then AI, which is sort of everything being automated and people's jobs being taken away, all of this one side, there's this one entire piece on sort of, you know, us needing to have humans in all the right places.
You need them in the loop. So, yeah.
Exactly. So that they can have that emotional side, that EQ piece, so that they can ensure that whatever is being decided is actually right, like, again, right on the right side of humanity.
Yeah.
So it's a blend that we need to do, which means that it's literally now harder.
Hmm.
Had we just said, oh, let's disrupt all the courts in the world, that's easier to do than let's say, oh, let's partner with all the courts
Let's coexist. And actually, exactly. And actually, it's why, if you think about how the legal system works, you know, so the reason we have a jury of 12 people in the UK and the US and elsewhere is because you could follow the letter of the law, but there are always humanistic or humanitarian reasons why, okay, maybe in this particular instance, there is a judgment to be made as to whether mm-hmm. it is, you know, whether it falls out. Like, we live in a world of gray, not of black and white, I guess.
Exactly.
Is the point.
Exactly.
Right?
And nothing in life is black and white. I actually have a lot of thoughts on like the jury model in the UK and the US. So India used to have a jury model and we've not had it, I think, for like 40, 50 years now. So, I mean, a jury that can let O.J. Simpson get away with murder is not something that also needs to be there. So I think there's like a balance, like maybe a sort of jurors need to be like trained in certain contexts. And there needs to be some sort of like a veto power that exists in certain humanitarian cases, whatever. I think there's, like I said, it's not binary. It needs to be gray. So I think there needs to be like certain structures and processes across the world in tech as well, where we are accepting and embracing the gray and building like products and solutions and infrastructures that support operating in the gray than making everything binary.
Yeah, I actually, because I think about this a lot when people talk about AI taking over kind of accountants and finance and sort of this sort of thing. And what I always get to is, but at the most strategic level of finance, of law, et cetera, there is human judgment always involved, right? Again, accounting works on, yes, some black and white principles, but actually a lot of it is also around contracts and how, you know, how things are interpreted. And that is why you can have an argument with your auditor around whether this revenue recognition makes sense or doesn't. And the problem I keep coming back to is, yeah, you could automate all of that away. But when it comes to needing the people to make those judgments, if you don't have enough people coming in at the bottom to be able to make those judgments by gaining experience and working their way up the chain, you're gonna have issues down the track, right? So you could solve for a lot of stuff day one, but then you'll get into trouble sort of when you need people to actually make those value judgments down the track. So yeah, I mean, I think again, this is a topic that I think we could probably talk about for a long time. Yeah. But you said to me relatively recently that Ethereum is the Hugging Face, which is the machine learning and data science platform and community that helps users build, deploy, and train machine learning models of blockchain, right? So Ethereum is the Hugging Face of blockchain. So for our audience, can you explain what you mean by that and why this is an important thing for the protocol and the broader Web3 ecosystem?
Absolutely. So I think I am in awe of both the companies separately. Of course, they don't have any overlay in terms of tech or the product that they have actually built at all. But it is the ethos of the two companies that I can draw parallels between, which is that Hugging Face sort of started out as a chatbot and then kind of pivoted into this open source community, building and helping others build models, like small models that they can kind of share with each other and then improve upon or edit or have a conversation around.
Yeah.
That ethos basically comes from a space where, you know, not token gating innovation and interests of humanity and letting everyone have like a level playing ground, like a playground where they can actually kind of compare, contrast, learn, teach everything together. Mm-hmm. That basically is what Hugging Face was able to kind of create very early on, which is why they are where they are today, right? Even as a marketplace or like as a platform, they have the most loyal developer base that I've ever seen in AI, right? Mm-hmm. Like they are now literally known as the GitHub of AI.
Yeah.
And it's funny that like a company like from scratch was able to become as big as GitHub in the era where GitHub already exists, mm-hmm. right? So it's all because of the kind of community and the ethos that they were able to bring in, which acted as a wedge, and all AI developers, researchers gravitated towards them.
And I guess it was, I think GitHub was acquired by Microsoft, right? So then there was, again, okay, who is controlling, you know, who has access, who has control? And then people get, you know, get upset. And then, so how does Ethereum then kind of do the same thing?
So on the Ethereum piece, that's pretty much similar because, you know, Vitalik, one of the earlier, I remember this is like back in 2016 or 17, one of the blogs that he wrote was all around sort of the problems that he still faced in Ethereum. Mm-hmm. Imagine a founder of a company that is already running into like millions or billions is saying, oh, these are the challenges, like technical challenges that me and my team have not been able to solve for. So like, you know, asking the wider blockchain developer community, hey, why don't you reach out and why don't you come and experiment with what we have built mm-hmm. and tell us how we can improve versus how you can actually help us solve the technical issues. So that is basically something that, again, very few founders have done. This resulted in this eagerness because, you know, the ETH community was also very strong and they had some of the best talent in the world by then. So like they ended up like attracting all these developers who would come in and start experimenting. I remember there was this one point where like, I think there were like 25 or like 55,000 smart contracts deployed on Ethereum, very, very early days. Mm-hmm. And none of them were actually businesses or products or apps. They were just developers coming in and tinkering, mm-hmm. literally. And I did this exercise. I can actually, I think I published it as well. I'm not sure. Back in like 2019. I tracked as to like the time at which they were deployed, mm-hmm. the smart contracts, mm-hmm. and when like these developers were coming in and having like conversations around it or posting it. So I ran a query, I got all that data, and then I put it on the map. Like I obviously tracked like the website hits as well by geography, and I overlaid the two. And basically the result that I came up with was everyone was working at like 2 a.m. at night. Very clear to me, like, you know, these are people who are sort of fully employed, gainfully employed, but this is something new that's interesting. They want to come home after dinner, sit and start coding or writing something that could be sort of, you know, like that could pique their interest. And then they would deploy it.
Yeah.
And like across, and so many of them were obviously using VPNs as well. So I would either see like a 2 a.m. or 2 to 4 a.m. kind of a spike, or I would see like a 12 to 3 p.m. kind of spike.
Sure.
Right. So basically when, you know, you've started doing your work, you're suddenly very bored and you would start doing your own personal project right before and after lunch, or you would do it late at night, mm. which basically proved to me, this is how a community is born. Mm-hmm. The day I did this study, I remember I bought so much Ethereum that day because I was so impressed by how they were actually able to create a community of blockchain developers when in reality, there was actually no use case of blockchain that was visible at that time,
yeah.
right? Or there was not enough venture funding that had come into the space.
So it became basically like a sandbox, essentially, for these.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And sort of like, you know, away from regulations, risks, mainstream tech, you know, the sort of the token gating walled gardens, they were just able to create like a community where blockchain developers were able to come and thrive, which is exactly what I saw in Hugging Face as well. Mm. So I think the two of these companies, they were able to create these ecosystems, which I don't think anyone could have actually overtaken. And it's similar to, if you think about it, it's similar to what sort of even Meta did in the earlier days, which is how they got like all these college students,
yeah,
right, to actually come and have a profile on Meta. So it's basically the developer version in AI and the developer version in blockchain that Hugging Face and Ethereum respectively have managed to create. It's always all about community.
Yeah.
Across so many different sectors, we've seen that now.
Yeah. And I think that's only growing. I mean, we're seeing it across, I mean, all businesses are trying to figure out how they can build community, not just customers, right? Like, I mean, that is the holy grail. Ash, it has been absolutely incredible talking to you today. For our audience, where can they find you online? You on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where's the best place for them to find you?
I am very formal and professional on LinkedIn. I am very random and sort of like opinionated and contrarian on Twitter. Uh-huh. And I am very Gen Z on Instagram, okay, and Snapchat. So pick your poison. connect with me anywhere that suits your personality and your interests, and I will definitely respond.
Amazing. Ash, it's been really incredible speaking today to you today. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate and love the conversation.
Thank you so much, Arish. This was so wonderful. Really, really thoughtful questions. I really enjoyed myself. Didn't even realize an hour went away. So thanks a lot for that.
Amazing.